Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. It is the Charlotte Line. I am your host, Zach. Dr. John is not feeling well and is tired, so we figure we'll give him a day off so he can relax and get better. He does not have the coronavirus. Instead, he just has, I don't want to know. But it is one of your hosts, Zach, here at Studio G. And also, as always, my good friend, good pal, and all-around good guy, Brady Van Sickle up in Des Moines, Iowa, where they still have not had snow yet.
Thank God. It's only October, Zach. If we're getting snow here, I'm going to sue someone. But then again, it's 2020, honestly. If there was ever going to be a year where we're going to get snow around Halloween, it would definitely be this year. But no, happy to be here. We got plenty to talk about here. Where do you want to get started today?
Let's see here. Bowman to the 48, old news. Grovel, old news. No, I think we just started that big one that dropped today that we all, not a lot of people saw coming, and I still surprisingly heard nothing about. Alex Bowman, driver of the number 88 for Hendrick Motorsports, will be moving to the 48 number and possibly taking his crew chief and his spotter with him to the number 48 Chevy next year, leaving the 88 seat open right now, and potentially some big stuff happening with that with other drivers, possibly a Kyle Larson or even some other drivers.
And there are still plenty of big names with unannounced plans for 2021. I'm scrolling right now. Past three huge names, like you mentioned, Kyle Larson, who put out a very emotional and heartfelt speech right before the beginning of the Talladega weekend, addressing the steps he's taken in his road to recovery and just how he's been trying to educate himself and understand why the actions he displayed during that iRace and the fallout from it, you know, the meaning behind that. And just everything he's learning about trying to better educate himself about that whole community. So that really has come on the heels of a lot of intense rumors about Kyle Larson maybe exploring a potential ride with Hendrick Motorsports. And I had also seen a lot of speculation that Ally was kind of eyeing Bowman. Bowman's now been with the team since 2018 in a full-time capacity. And he's really shown he has the raw, untapped potential to be a true championship contender one day. And Allies, like you and I were talking right before we got on there, I really feel like they're looking at NASCAR as a key way of building their business and growing their marketing. They really see the value in marketing and sponsorship through NASCAR, and I really think that this is a start of a long-term and hopefully prosperous relationship. You know, with Jimmy Johnson retiring, they were needing someone up and coming that they could build their brand with. And this could be the second chapter of the 48, where kind of like when Lowe's took a chance on Jimmy Johnson, Ally could be taking a chance on Alex Bowman, and we could be seeing another dynasty in the making. And like you were talking, because I kind of wondered why they just didn't move the sponsorship over, but you brought up a really good point that I didn't even really consider about since they've already established now two full-time seasons on the 48, they probably wanted to keep that consistency from a brand and marketing perspective. So that there made a lot of sense. So I'm really excited for that move, but that kind of begs the question here, Zach, where I'm going to open it up to you. What becomes of Hendrick Motorsports? I've seen everything from there being speculation of them kind of downsizing back to a – ran out of voice there. But seeing rumors about them maybe downsizing back to a three-car team, kind of like what they were in the 90s. Still seeing a lot of heavy speculation that they're going to try and remain a four-car operation, just trying to find the funding for it. So what do you see kind of happens from here? Do you see another driver filling the void? Do you see them maybe downsizing? So where do you see this going?
I see this going to Hendrick staying at a four-car team. They haven't had a downfall or a need to downgrade, kind of like, I'm going to put it out there, is Roush Fenway Racing. I mean, Roush itself had not been winning races or been competitive. Yes, they'd won two races in the past 3 years, but other than that, their wins have not come to fruition that much. I don't see them scaling back operations because of the fact they are still getting wins. Yes, the 48 has not won a race, but the 9, the 24, and the 88 have won races this year. And there's still the big thing of that. There was actual talks with drivers and even secret meetings that not a lot of people knew about or the media didn't know anything about with drivers to fulfill empty seat that we're going to call it now, because we know who's going in the 48, but we don't know who's going in the 88 or maybe a possibly a new number. I feel we right now will know, yes, there's still that empty seat. And I still think we're going to have that. We're going to have an empty seat where we will get a driver, whether it's a smaller driver such as Corey LaJoie is a name getting thrown around because he's actually talked to Rick Hendrick, gave him a very heartfelt letter, and it has proven not just to himself but to other people that he is competitive when he's able to. I look at Talladega, Daytona, and even some of the road courses. He's not that bad, but then you have people like Kyle Larson, and even this one not a lot of people know about, Chase Briscoe. This one's really interesting. Not a lot of people know that Jimmy Johnson tried to talk him into coming to Hendrick Motorsports or being a Hendrick development driver many years ago when he kind of started doing more truck stuff. Obviously, program, but with Chase Briscoe now being in this opportunity with almost 10 wins this season in the Xfinity Series, and if he wants to go cup racing, there's a possibility we could see a shift in Chase going from a Ford at Stewart Haas or wherever to a Chevy with this, because it's something that Jimmy Johnson has been, I don't want to say a mentor or anything, but has talked highly of Chase Briscoe himself. So I feel like, to sum up the question real quick, I feel like Hendrick's going to stay a four-car operation. The possibility of what driver is going to do what is still up in the air.
And honestly, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I've been seeing a lot more rumors intensifying in the last few weeks. Kind of, they're old rumors from like the beginning part of quarantine, about Clint Bowyer possibly retiring and maybe going to the Fox sports booth next season to fill the void left by longtime broadcaster Darrell Waltrip. And to me, that made a lot of sense, but only if Clint is ready to hang up his career, because I really feel like he's still got a lot to prove, and I'm still baffled that him and the Stewart Haas combo hasn't yielded better results and more wins. But there's still a lot of speculation there, but the reason I've been seeing a lot of those rumors been popping up recently is a lot more speculation about Briscoe going to the 14. And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I could totally see the businessman that Rick Hendrick is going after Briscoe after the season that he's put together. We've seen him do it before, where he's seen untapped potential that really didn't have a clear path to cup and went in there and gave them a cup ride and became the real winner in that situation. We saw it, you know, with William Byron, when he was almost looked like he was going to be fast-tracked for a Toyota deal before Junior Motorsports and Hendrick got him back into the fold. But we've also seen them lose drivers. You know, Brad Keselowski easily comes to mind, because they didn't have the cup rides available. So I'll be interested to see where this goes. But it would make sense if Hendrick was trying to court Briscoe, being a reason why I'm starting to see more speculation about Clint Bowyer possibly not returning to the 14, despite what we had heard early on in August from the team principal, Greg Zipidelli, confirming that he was under the impression that the roster was going to stay the same. So the only reason I could see that would change between August and now is, like you said, if Hendrick maybe tried to try and woo him away to a cup deal where there really wasn't one seemingly open at Stewart Haas at the time. So interesting to see how the silly season dominoes fall. Zach? Hello? Well, I'm not sure where Zach went, but we'll just continue on there. So lots to dig into here. There's still plenty of drivers that don't have announced plans for 2021, those including Ty Dillon and Eric Jones, who both confirmed before the Talladega race this last Sunday that they do not have any plans in place for next season. So it'll be interesting to see where we go from there on those two drivers. Still, the rides potentially at the Spire Motorsports. Oh, is there that?
Do you hear me?
Yep, I hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yes, that's honest. I think my headset had a freak out, evidently. I'm not too sure what's going on.
Well, we're glad to have you back here. But kind of, where did you leave off at? Because I kind of wrapped up on my Chase Briscoe rant there, and I really was intrigued by the information you brought up, because I kind of started putting a few of the puzzle pieces in place for me over some of the rumors I've been seeing on the interwebs.
Well, in all honesty, this is what I think. I think Briscoe has an opportunity to do something crazy and to do something that's going to forward his career even further, but it's still speculations. I mean, last year you can look at him. He did not have a ride confirmed until almost January. And right now there's so many open doors for so many different opportunities, whether they are, like you said, actually the Spire guys who will have a two-car team next year, along with the 32, who, even though they aren't the best equipment for a young driver to come in, maybe for a year to, I don't want to say be a field filler, but to maybe potentially bring on like Stuart Haas and equipment to the 32 team, if Chase Briscoe wanted to stay with Ford, that would be a good thing for him to do, because he would get a lot of track time at tracks that he has not raced at or tracks that he's never really seen before, and B, it would give him an opportunity to see how these cup cars feel, so that the year following, he would be a little more better equipped with racing. So it's a whole big thing, and we still have so much more. I mean, at this point last year, we didn't know the silly season wasn't this vague. It wasn't this empty. We didn't have this many empty seats. All we had was a few things here and there, and that was it. And the biggest one, honestly, was Chase Briscoe in my mind, that, oh, yeah, Chase Briscoe doesn't have a ride yet, even though he was pretty decent last year.
And the other thing I kind of take away from this is we're speculating on drivers like Austin Cindric and Chase Briscoe, because those two drivers play a key role in the silly season picture. Because right now, Austin Cindric and Matt DiBenedetto are the two favorites for the Wood Brothers 21. And DiBenedetto updated this week that he hopes to hear this week whether or not he has that ride for next year or if he has to look elsewhere. So that could be a major shakeup, and then obviously this Briscoe deal. So we could see a couple more drivers from the Xfinity Series move up. What's interesting about that is there's a couple of big names in the Cup Series that have been around for the last few years that have stated publicly that they are willing to go down to the Xfinity Series to drive a competitive car in a means to kind of reprove themselves. One of those being Corey LaJoie, like you mentioned earlier. He's been talked about for a few rides, but he has openly stated that if a competitive Xfinity ride opens up, like potentially one of those two Ford options if those guys get promoted, or potentially maybe even a drive with Joe Gibbs Racing, because I've heard even rumors that maybe Riley Herbst might not be safe for that 18 ride. So that could be a potential there. So we could see Corey LaJoie possibly maybe take a step back to try and rebuild his career. Also Ty Dillon. He said that right before the Talladega broadcast, that he still has nothing lined up, and even he's willing to go back to the Xfinity Series. And he even phrased it that way, that he goes, if I have to reprove myself to the garage area, I will. Because he goes, I'm at the most competitive that I've ever felt in my life. I feel like I'm really on top of my game and really understand what it takes to drive these cars fast. And if I have to go back down to reprove myself so I can get a legit shot at Cup, then I'll do what it takes, because he really fully believes that as he approaches his 30s, that now is the time when he can really contend for wins and championships if given the right deal. So we could see some huge dominoes fall here in the next few weeks. Like you said, it's really odd to be this late in the season and have so much uncertainty around the Cup Series, but also the Xfinity Series too. When it comes to these big-name rides and these high-dollar rides, usually sponsorship is shored up so well in advance, but with COVID really throwing a wrench in things and, you know, the outlook for 2021 being kind of hazy, I feel like a lot of sponsors are being kind of hesitant right now about backing deals like this. And I feel like it's a little bit harder to put together the full package, because we've still got, I believe, by my count, probably a good half dozen pretty fairly competitive cup rides that are still open. So it'll be interesting to see where all those dominoes fall and who ends up filling those seats.
It will be interesting, especially with a lot of different potential coming up. the biggest one I'm looking forward to, no matter what, that we know for sure, is Christopher Bell going to the 20 next year. And the big reason is Christopher Bell did so great in his first year, or for his Xfinity series that he did for Joe Gibbs Racing. Then gets an opportunity with the Fine Family, with Vine Family Racing, does really good with them. COVID hits and kind of, you know, makes Levine shut down, which is unfortunate because they're a great organization. And in Chris's contract, he had a 3-year contract with Joe Gibbs Racing, essentially guaranteeing him for Levine, then Levine or Joe Gibbs Racing, then Joe Gibbs Racing at the end of that. And that kind of put some guy out in the woods, Derek Jones, to kind of fend for himself and figure out what he wants to do. But honestly, I'm looking really forward to seeing what Christopher Bell can do in Joe Gibbs equipment, full-time Joe Gibbs equipment.
Honestly, I'm glad you brought him up, because one of the biggest question marks on the free agency right now arguably has to be Eric Jones. I mean, yes, his Cup career has not been everything it probably could have been, and he's definitely failed to live up to expectations, but I still feel like he can get the job done. I feel like that he's the kind of talent that warrants a second chance, kind of like Joey Logano did. But the question really remains, where is he going to go? Because there really hasn't been any strong rumors for Eric Jones. I mean, he was kind of tossed around for the 48 ride, but in those conversations, he was easily the fourth driver in line in a lot of those speculations. There was talks briefly about maybe him going to the 43, but those talks quickly cooled when they stated that they're looking for a driver in the diversity program to kind of continue their recent trend. So that door's kind of seemingly closed. He could end up at Spire, but I see his name being more heavily tied, though, to JDG Doherty Racing, because I'm seeing a lot of rumors being thrown around that they're maybe looking at a change of pace. They brought in Ricky Stenhouse this year, and Ryan Preece has really not gotten up to speed, you know, as quickly as I feel like they thought he was going to. I honestly am not super shocked, because I really thought that they rushed him up to a Cup deal well before he was ready. So I'm already starting to see rumors about Preece maybe going down to a pretty competitive Xfinity ride, maybe going back to be reunited with Joe Gibbs Racing. But that would leave the door open for maybe Eric Jones to possibly slot in and be a teammate. Could I see that being a good move? It has the potential, because I really feel like JTG Doherty as a team is so close to moving up to that next level of competitiveness. You know, I've seen them really grow as an organization over this last decade, and really seen the care that not only Tad and Jody Geschechter, wow, that's a mouthful of a last name, and also Brad Doherty has put in the team to try and make it successful. I really feel like that they just need that little extra push, and I feel like the raw talent that Jones has could really help bolster that team a lot. And I feel like the move that we heard over the offseason, just also this last week, that was kind of buried, that Hendrick Motorsports and Richard Childress Racing are going to team up to create a unified Chevy power plant to make all the Chevys next year a lot more competitive, to be more unified under one engine program. So I think that move is really going to help not just obviously Hendrick Motorsports and Richard Childress, but the Chevy or all the Chevy manufacturer backed teams as a whole, and specifically JTG Doherty, which had a bit of a slip in performance this year, I got to say. So they're definitely looking for the rebound next year. And I really feel like that they might, if they can land the Eric Jones deal, I really feel like they might be able to kind of turn things around and maybe build towards a really bright future with the advent of the next-gen car.
For sure. And that's actually one that I think that was after we did our show last week, that Hendrick Motorsports and RCR essentially announced, saying that they will both be doing essentially a motor program together to help Chevy with their dominance, even though they haven't had it this year. That's a good thing for them, but that also does bring to light, you know, Eric Jones and his possibilities and the ventures and possibly what JTG Doherty wants to do. If I was Doherty, I would honestly try to find a way to keep Ryan Preece signed on, kind of like Christopher, Oh, who's the 17 right now?
Chris Buescher.
Buescher. Kind of like Jack Rush of Chris Buescher. Sign him on, keep him on, but lend him out to other teams. Let's say Daughtry asked Ryan Preece to go do a couple years in Xfinity, which even though he has done that, he did not do that in competitive equipment. He did partial seasons with Joe Gibbs Racing and, you know, did great, got wins, and even beat Kyle Busch a couple times, which is not easy to do in any sort of form of racing, and keep him on, and then bring on Eric Jones, and then see what Eric can do. Then see who's going to be better. Is it going to be Eric Jones? Is it going to be Ricky Stenhouse Jr.? Or will it be Ryan Preece the following two seasons? So I look forward to see what's going to happen with all these drivers, and I do want to see these drivers stay. There's only a handful of drivers that are kind of getting to the end of their time. Obviously, Jimmy Johnson's one of them, and he's a big proponent saying, hey, I'm not done racing, but NASCAR I'm kind of done with because I want to go out on my own terms. And you have, you know, Brendan Gaughan, who this weekend raced his final quote-unquote race. I still think he's going to pull out for one more time in the Daytona 500. But then you got people like, you know, Kyle Busch, Martin Truex Jr., who are getting up there, even though they're still winning and competitive. It's just a matter of time before they decide, hey, I'm done racing, and give up their seats or their opportunities.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. We're on the precipice of what we kind of went through in the 2000s, where it's going to be the next changing of the guard. The drivers that you and I grew up watching and being the Gillette young guns, you know, the guys that were going to take the motorsports game by storm, they're quickly fading out. You know, we saw it first with Jeff Gordon, and then since then it's just been domino after domino. Stewart, Earnhardt Jr., Kenseth, Jimmy Johnson now. I don't think, you know, Kurt Busch is going to be too far behind them. Kevin Harvick's got a deal for 2023, but beyond that, you know, your guess is as good as mine. And like you said, even though Kyle Busch got in the game really young, you know, he's going to be approaching, you know, his 40s here soon. And, you know, he's done about everything he can. So, but I don't see him slowing down. Honestly, I could see him being in the Cup Series for another two decades. So Kyle not slowing down, but definitely a lot of other drivers, you know, you got to start wondering when they're going to start their exit. We're already starting to see rumors about Clint Bowyer possibly not coming back next year. I saw, you know, a brief rumor about maybe potentially even Kurt Busch not coming back next year. But I was like, nah, Kurt's got probably at least one more year in him, but maybe might go out with the next gen car. I could see that, but no, it's gonna be a real interesting shift here, because the NASCAR of the 2020s is definitely gonna look far and wide different than the NASCAR of the 2000s that you and I grew up with. So now I know what it's like to be old.
I know what it's like to be old, utterly Chino. But that, you know, I'm just glad, because we still get to talk about racing action. We still get to have these conversations about drivers we grew up with. And then, like you said, I think Kurt Busch will stay for another year. I hope Clint Bowyer does. Knowing Clint and how much of a dirt guy, if he does leave this year, we know for a fact he'll come back. He'll race Bristol. We know that. Whether it's an Xfinity, Truck, Cup, whatever, we know he'll be back for some dirt action, because he loves that. But I'm just looking forward to, A, this weekend, and B, what the end of the season is going to be with all these teams. Because I guarantee you, by Christmas, all but maybe one seat will be filled.
Oh, yeah, no. And honestly, I've already started to see, you know, rumors speculating that we should see maybe a lot more of the rides be filled up, you know, actually within the next 2 weeks. I was starting to see maybe speculation that with us already going to be neck deep in the round of eight, that we're going to start to see a lot of announcements being made. The biggest of which obviously being the 48, we now know who's going to be the heir apparent to that dynasty, but there's still a lot of big names out there. So we'll definitely keep you guys updated as best we can. But you mentioned it, there's a lot of excitement brewing around this weekend, because we're getting down to it. Just five more weekends of racing for NASCAR. Well, there wouldn't be all this, you know, hype and, you know, and all this anticipation for this week if we didn't have what was honestly the only way you can describe it, absolute insanity, chaos last weekend at Talladega. What a weekend. And controversy to boot. I mean, that yellow line, blasted, bloody yellow line. But where should we start? The Truck Series, the Chevy Silverado 250 on a noon hour race, a nice way to wake up on your Saturday when you wake up and you don't want to wake up at a decent time because, the rules, who makes them, you know? We got the Truck Series, and what a race it was. It was a cutoff race for them. Zach, take us through it. What did we see?
Let's be honest. You were probably hungover, so you're like, I don't want to wake up at 9 a.m. to watch a race.
9 a.m.? Nah, bro. It was at a crisp 11, and I had a DVR, so when I woke up, I got to start it at noon and fast-forward through all the commercials. Actually, no, I was... I was out of town, so I came back late and had to watch it that afternoon. I forgot I did things Friday night.
I did things. But, yes, this race, Talladega, plate racing for the trucks. We only get two plate races from these guys a year. It is the opener at Daytona. It's the actual first race NASCAR puts on. That is a points race. I guess the dual race is counting now, too, somewhat. But the actual full points race. And when it comes to both those tracks, we always get chaos. And holy crap, not only did we see people in a crash on lot 12 get taken out, like Zane Smith, who made the cutoff. Let me repeat that. Zane Smith, who crashed on lap 4 or on lap 12, made the cutoff. How? Then you had people like Hayden Fogelman, Danny Pohl, Dawson, like a lot of smaller guys, even Spencer Boyd, last year's winner, unfortunately getting wound up in that crash. And then you see people like Kaz Grala, who's not raced a truck for a couple years, in fact has not had a full season or anything for a few years, gets the opportunity because Natalie Decker has not been cleared by NASCAR to race because of medical reasons, coming out strong with a 9th place finish. And even people like Trevor Bayne in a Nice Motorsports finishing 2nd, but we have to give it to the race winner, one of the 3 Canadians in this race, Raphael Lazard for Kyle Busch Motorsports.
Oh, yeah, no, what a great win for Raphael. It's been a bit of a learning curve for him. It's his rookie season. He's not had a whole lot of stock car starts in NASCAR, so definitely has been learning on the fly. COVID's not helped with the lack of practice, and I could see every week he was just getting a little bit better, just a little bit better. And I feel like he's been kind of overshined and overshadowed by his teammate Christian Eckes, who made the playoffs, you know, and has been a lot more consistent. But by being the first one to get their win, you know, and beat Christian to that punch, I feel like it's going to carry so much confidence for Raphael heading into these last few weeks. You know, he could really hang his head high, you know, because that win was not handed to him by any means, and he had to earn it. He narrowly held off a former Daytona 500 winner and Trevor Bayne to take that. So if that tells you anything, the kid definitely earned that first win. So, and you could see in the emotion he was expressing post-race that it just meant the world to him to be able to put that together, to come all this way and to see it all, you know, come to fruition like this. It was just really rewarding, and I really hope that he gets a shot at a second season because I feel like through his rookie year, it's been challenging, but he's been consistent. He's been bringing trucks home in one piece. And while he's not been flashy, I feel like if given the chance to develop and really grow into his own, he could be a really stout competitor in the NASCAR ranks. So I hope that this at least secures him maybe one more deal for next year, and we'll see where he goes from there. But, you know, behind Raphael, you mentioned it right there, Kaz Grala, another top 10. He joins Kyle Busch in a very unique distinction of being one of only 2 drivers to score a top 10 in all 3 national divisions this year in 2020. So that's pretty cool company when you get to say you're in the same sentence as Kyle Busch.
That is, and Kaz Grala, you know, kind of got the phone call, not last minute, but something was just like, hey, because he raced, I believe, last week's race for Natalie Decker in the 44. And then Nice was like, hey, do you want to race again? And, you know, brought him back out to do another race at Daytona. And obviously he did great for himself, finishing 9th. Like you said, one of only one other driver right now in the sport to be able to score a top 10. He scored a top 10 in Cup at a track he's never raced at and a Cup car. Never raced a Cup car, mind you. One got a top 10 in Xfinity and a top 10 here. By the way, even though he did get 2 top 10s or a top 10 at Daytona, it's not the same configuration as Talladega. That was road course racing. So that's a huge thing for him. It shows he still has a lot of talent. I mean, you think back a couple of years ago, he was running for, I think it was like JPG Racing or something like that. I can't remember what the team name was. But they shut down because the owner actually evidently had really bad health concerns and had to pull out so he could pay for all his medical stuff. Lost his ride. Then Fury said, hey, we'll make Xfinity cars. And they took some amazing cars and even a chassis that was over 10 years old, an old showcase car, basically a showcase meaning it was taken around to show around, do demos or whatever. Got modified to run at Talladega of all places and ran really well. And he's still showing, hey, I got life in me. Even though he's a driver for RCR part-time, I think this year has proven that he's someone that a team should really look forward or look to get for next year.
Honestly, both him and Anthony Alfredo, you mentioned the part-time Richard Childress Racing deal. Richard Childress, I don't know if he knows it, but he is sitting on two of the hottest prospects, in my opinion, in the garage right now. Gralla and Alfredo, they both share time in that 21, and they've been able to lend themselves to other driving duties, most notably Gralla being able to be more flexible. And I just continue to be amazed by the effort that they put in every time that they not only wheel that drive, but also any time that they get another racing opportunity, that just the level of talent that they possess and just how few starts they have in the stock car ranks. Because I look at both of their records, and both of them, Gralla obviously has a couple of full-time seasons in the truck, but Alfredo hardly has anything to his credit, and both of them just continue to, you know, raise the standard and set the high bar. So I hope both of them honestly land a full-time gig for next year, because I feel like they both would earn it. But, no, for Gralla, it was a hell of a race there. But honestly, a miracle that he got there, because if you're looking down, you know, through the breakdown of the yellow flags here, there was just so much carnage. The started right out the get-go. You said right there on lap 12. Unfortunately, Zane Smith got wiped up in it, and everyone thought he was done. Even he thought that his championship hopes were dashed right there. He came in with such a nice cushion. I think he had a 39-point margin over the cutoff because he had done so well in the regular season, and by doing so, that point cushion is what saved Zane Smith's championship hopes, because had he not had that, he would have been completely done right there. But as the race progressed on, you know, a couple more of his championship competitors ran into some issues, the first of which would be Todd Gilliland, whose engine let go, and that was the final nail in his coffin, as he had had a couple of bad runs in the prior two races, and so that effectively put his championship to an end. And then coming down on that last lap, there was a wreck in the backstretch that ended up putting the race under a yellow flag to finish the event. And swept up in that event, in that accident, was Christian Eckes, another driver who needed a good run at Talladega to maybe try and leapfrog over Zane Smith's poor outing. But unfortunately, Eckes got swept up in that and did not have the points to overcome that. And so Eckes and Todd Gilliland were your first two drivers eliminated from the championship in the truck series. And Zane Smith gets to live a fine another day. They have a week off before they head to Kansas Motor Speedway next week. And I honestly, at this point, I really can't pick a favorite. Austin Hill, you know, he comes to mind, but he kind of had a rough go at Talladega. But, I mean, that's just Talladega being Talladega. In my opinion, even though he's not won the season, you really can't count out a guy like Brett Moffitt, a former champion, and he's just been so damn consistent. I feel like he's just on the precipice of just reeling off a bunch of wins and maybe going to the championship. So he's got to come to mind. His two teammates, Sheldon Creed, Zane Smith, they've both had phenomenal seasons. I feel like they could, if given the right scenario, could be a surprise dark horse for that title bid. And who knows? The wily veteran, Matt Crafton, could silently, you know, point his way into the championship four and sneak another one out from underneath the kids. So it's so wide open right now, and that's why I love the truck series. And this was the proper fitting finale to their opening round. I could not have scripted a better final race for their cutoff to stir up the drama, stir up the intensity. And it's just trucks, man. What can I say more than that? They fucking know how to put on a show.
Well, not just them, the guys on pit road. If you watched during Austin Hill's pit stop as he was leaving, he actually clipped one of Jordan Anderson's tire changers from the rear. Did you see that?
I did see that. I forgot to put that in my Lego recap. Damn.
Well, what's funny is I actually know his name's Kyle. I'm not going to say his last name, but Kyle is he's something else to say the least. I sent him a message. I'm like, hey, how you feeling? He goes, damn, dude, I understand now what you went through at Kansas a few years ago. I'm like, yeah, it's not that fun, is it? Because he said, oh, it's nothing crazy. But give him credit. If you haven't seen it, I don't know if it's on Twitter or where it's at, but I saw a clip of his GoPro footage and just the fact that he gets laid out and the broadcast actually cuts after he gets laid out. He's on the ground laying down. You're like, oh man, he's not getting back up. If you see his clip, it's basically him. He's down, he's backed up, and he's going to change tires, and it ripped the air hose off the gun, so he had to reattach it. So, and in the broadcast, he even was going straight to work. He was doing tire pressures and checking the depths of tires. So that was something else. And then something else that kind of caught my eye was just the fact of Jennifer Jo Cobb. If you haven't heard of her, she's kind of a back burner in the truck series. I don't want to say she hasn't done well for herself. She races hard. She's a great woman, to say the least. But she led for 16 laps, which is the most a woman driver has ever led in the NASCAR truck series and even the Xfinity series right now.
And, you know, I've met Jennifer Jo several times. She really carries herself well. She's a savvy businesswoman, and you've got to admire what she's done over this last decade. She runs, maintains, and operates a truck team. She's the only full, like, single-owned woman-owner driver in the sport, and it's just continues to amaze me how she shows up to the track. You know, she doesn't do anything flashy, but she shows up week to week. She's given several drivers, you know, an opportunity to maybe run one of her cars if the sponsorship deal's right. And it was just so great to see her out front getting that recognition and to now have that distinction for at least for now to have the most consecutive laps like that. It was just such a great moment and for such an outstanding pioneer for women in the sport. So I was really happy to see that. And honestly, you know, that's kind of an interesting segue. You know, we're still going to get to a few more stories here before we wrap up on Talladega, but looking ahead, the next race will be at Kansas Motor Speedway here in 2 weeks. And I'm already starting to see speculation and rumors that Haley Deegan might be getting her truck series debut in the number 17 truck for David Gilliland Crosley Racing. So maybe keep an eye out for that as maybe being a potential announcement, because Haley Deegan definitely one of those drivers that's definitely benefited from a woman like Jennifer Jo Cobb, you know, laying the groundwork, setting the pathway to get what's been a fantastic opportunity for her young career. She's shown she's got a lot of promise, a lot of talent behind the wheel. She's great with her marketing, with her sponsors. So from a marketing side, she's the full package from what you want from a driver. And, you know, if it wasn't for women like Jennifer Jo Cobb, Danica Patrick, Shauna Robinson, Janet Guthrie, and, you know, Patty Moise, the list goes on and on, that just made those little chips, those little dents, and those little small victories, like leading 16 laps at Talladega, you know, we wouldn't have the exciting young prospect that is Haley Deegan or even Natalie Decker when she occasionally, you know, shows that flash of brilliance that got her to where she is, you know, today. So I was really, really happy for that, and I'll be interested to see if anything comes of that potential announcement with the Deegan and the 17 deal.
It is interesting, and it is something that, so to put it in perspective before people get their hopes up and stuff, there is essentially two or three entry lists. With how early this one is, it's a prelim, essentially. It's something that, right, what numbers are going to be here, what are organizations, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of times they do have drivers associated with them, and a lot of times they don't at the same time. For instance, there was a couple years ago when I want to say it was Kyle was speculated to run a race at it was Texas, or it was one of the southern races, and he wasn't on the list, but then – the week that the official list came out, he was on there. So it is interesting to see. Now, there has been times where a driver was on that list, a prelim list, 2 weeks out, and then out of the blue, they were off of it, whether it was a sponsorship deal or whether it was just to put a name to the spot, which is something they do. It's possible that's what this is, but I think, in all honesty, with the backing Haley Deegan has, what she has done so far in the ARCA series and the K&N series when that was a thing, and what she did this weekend, the ARCA series was at the Springfield Mile, a dirt track. She finished second with that car. So, in all honesty, it's very hard to tell what's going to happen, but hopefully we will see her in the truck this weekend or next weekend.
Oh, yes. But now, bringing things back to Alabama, though, like we said, we have now set our round of eight for the championship. Austin Hill, Brett Moffitt, Ben Rhodes, Zane Smith, Sheldon Creed, Matt Crafton, Grant Infinger, and Tyler Ankrum still have hopes of hoisting a championship come Phoenix. So with that, that kind of puts the kebabs on our truck series recap. We'll give you the full race rundown, the full field rundown here. Rafael Assard, again, took the checkered flag. Trevor Bain came across the line in second. Chandler Smith came home in third. Ben Rhodes brought the number 99 home in fourth. Cody Rohrbaugh, an impressive fifth to go with his top five finish in Daytona early in the season. So fantastic runs for that number nine team on the Super Speedway events. Right behind him, also backing up his impressive Daytona finish, was Jordan Anderson, bringing the number three home in sixth place. Brett Moffitt came home in seventh, Matt Crafton in eighth. Again, Kaz Grala came home in the ninth place position, and Derek Krause rounded out the top 10. Johnny Sauter came home in 11th. Sheldon Creed came home in 12th. Grant Infinger in 13th. Clay Greenfield in 14th. Bailey Curry in 15th. Tyler Ankrum came home in 16th. Stuart Friesen, 17th. Christian Eckes, after that last lap crash, came home 18th. Austin Hill came home in 19th, and Austin Wayne Self rounded out the top 20. In 21st place, we had Brian Duzet. 22nd, we had Norm Benning. In 23rd, Josh Reum. 24th place went to Jennifer Jo Cobb after leading those 16 laps. In 25th place, we had Jason White. Robbie Lyons in 26th. Ray Ciccarelli in 27th. Todd Gilliland brought the number 38 home 28th after his engine let go. Tanner Gray pounded the inside wall after trying to avoid the 38 after his engine let go. Gray's wrecked the 15 and brought home the 29th place finish. Gus Dean pounded the inside wall right outside of pit lane and brought home a 30th place run. Tate Fogelman, Chase Purdy, and Zane Smith, Danny Bone, Dawson Cram, Corbin Forster, all those drivers, including Joe Nemechek and Spencer Boyd, your drivers through 38, they all got wrapped up in that lap 12 crash and would not finish the event.
Oof.
Oof is right. But with that, we turn our attention to an equally chaotic Xfinity race. Just like the truck race that was run on Saturday, and woof, what an event. And what a domination. You know, we had Justin Allgaier, who's kind of, not Justin Allgaier, Justin Haley, too many Justin.
Hey.
Justin Haley. Justin Haley is kind of, you know, establishing himself as maybe being, you know, the new, this new generation's next Dale Earnhardt Jr., you know, the plate guru, the master, as it were. Three consecutive wins. That puts him in elite company with Earnhardt Jr. and his legendary father, Earnhardt Sr., as the only drivers to do that, which is a hell of a feat, especially considering today's wackiness and unpredictability, especially in the Xfinity races on super speedway tracks. But he was in the right place at the right time, and the seas just kind of parted.
For sure, yeah. Justin has become one hell of a plate racer. Now, technically, he has won four times on a plate track. That includes his win at Daytona in the Cup Series last year for Spire Motorsports at a rain-shortened Coca-Cola 400, Coke Zero 400, whatever they keep changing that race to. And this year, with getting three different wins at two at Talladega and one at Daytona, all super speedways, he's becoming a really great plate racer with the equipment he has. Now, I will say this, his consistency is not there as much as Ross's. He has quite a bit of top 10s, but he has more top 10s than anything, even top 5s. He doesn't have a whole bunch. But, I'm a little picky with Justin Haley. And the reason is not just because of, you know, his driving ability. He's proven that he has some sort of ability, getting 3 wins in the truck series, one at Gateway, one at Tire Motorsports Park up in Canada, and one at Texas in 2018 when he finished 3rd for the championship that year. But you got to be a little more consistent with the wins of that. Now, yes, he has put up some decent numbers at a road course of Indy this year. He placed 2nd. Richmond, he placed 2nd. And even Atlanta, when we got back to that track, he placed 3rd, as well as Kentucky. Now, the one thing I got to say is you can't win a championship just by winning plate races. We've seen that. It's not possible. Well, at least now it's possible. But used to before, you can't just win, you know, 2 or 3 plate races in one season to win. It's great, though. The fact is that you say Justin Haley, you said you think dominance at plate tracks. And that's something that I want to hear again, because the last person that had that you could truly say, yeah, he was dominant there at plate tracks, was, like you said, Dale Earnhardt Jr. He won 5 in a row at Talladega. His father knew how to run Daytona and Talladega to get the wins. So I like Justin, besides all the name changes he went through before he finally was like, all right, I'm going to stick with Justin. Gosh. But he still needs a little more proven to me at the other tracks. He's done really well, but I think you kind of said it earlier. I don't think he's going to win I don't think he's going to go to a cup ride next year full time.
See, I differ from you on that. I mean, I agree with you that he's got a lot more development. I feel like he needs a lot more time to really hone his craft and improve his drive. But this is where I differ from you. I fully expect him to be one of those 2 drivers driving for Spire Motorsports next year. I feel like the relationship he's built up with them kind of looking at 2021 is kind of just a write-off year for them to just build on and prepare for 2022 in the next gen car. To me, I feel like honestly it's a move that makes sense. You know, if Justin's okay with, you know, not being competitive for a couple of years, going to the Cup Series now, understanding, learning the Cup competition next year, and then learning the Cup car alongside everyone else in 2022, to me that makes sense, you know, for a team like Spire who's maybe trying to look towards building a team around a driver. But no, like you, I feel like he's got some rough areas he still needs to work on. This being his 2nd full-time season in Xfinity, and while he's got 3 wins on the year, and he can say that while his teammate cannot, definitely the consistency in their numbers is definitely where Justin needs to improve. And it's not like his numbers are bad or anything. He's been, you know, one of the, I'd say, arguably one of the top 6 drivers at any given point in the season. So I feel like, you know, he's got a strong foundation. Probably could use maybe at the bare minimum another year in Xfinity to really try and come into his own as a driver. But I fully expect him to be one of those drivers in line for the Spire Motorsports deal for next year. Not from anything like he's doing on track, but simply for what he can provide for that team as a potential driver to build maybe a dynasty around. Because I really feel like he has the potential to be a great NASCAR driver. So it'll be interesting to see what approach they take with developing his career moving forward.
I think, though, if I was Justin Haley, I would stay in Xfinity one more year. And the big reason is I don't want to go from a cup car that is older that I'm going to do a full season in and then have to switch everything over. If I was him, I'd run a couple tracks, kind of like he's done. He ran, I believe it was last year he ran, last year he ran Talladega, Sonoma, and Daytona where he got his win. This year he's ran Daytona and Talladega in cup cars for Colleague Racing and Spire. I would do something like that, do a few tracks like that, And then the following year, when we get the next gen car, go full time with that, because then not only will you be able to adjust faster because you're not used to the old cars, but you'll be able to go out there and give it your full swing compared to like, oh, well, this is how I liked it in the old car. Oh, this doesn't work, so I have to change this. If I was him, I wouldn't think about doing a cup car. If I know for a fact that, you know, Spire wants me, I'd tell him, hey, I'll do a part-time schedule with you, but I'm not doing a full-time until we get the next-gen car the year following, because I don't want to have two different learning curves thrown to me back-to-back, because that just spells a disaster. I'd rather have a crappy rookie year than a crappy rookie year and a crappy sophomore year because we had to do some major changes.
Differing thought processes there, but I could definitely see where you're coming from on that. But it'll be interesting to see there. But while we're on the topic, you know, of colleague racing, they've definitely been the team to talk about when it comes to super speedway racing, just because of the sheer dominance that those cars have shown since Daytona, really, of last year. And again, it looked like they were going to be, you know, the cars to beat until lap 47, about just shy of the halfway mark in the event. On a restart,
just shy.
But on the restart, they were just getting a restart from an earlier wreck, and coming up to speed, they hadn't even got to the line yet. The car started bottlenecking. I don't know if a driver spun their tires or what, but they bottlenecked up, and Ross Chastain just got drilled by Harrison Burton, who, it wasn't Burton's fault. He really just had nowhere to go because of the accordion effect there. And after the contact, it just instantly turned Ross Chastain's car dead right into the outside wall, and then he slowly listed down the banking in front of all the oncoming traffic and got drilled in the door by Colby Howard. It ended Howard's day, and honestly, for a while there, it looked like it might have ended Ross Chastain's day, and Chastain had already come into this event in kind of a pickle. He had had a subpar day in Las Vegas in the playoff opener. So he was needing a good run here and was banking on getting some playoff points. And because of that incident, he ended up not getting a whole lot of points. He ended up being able to salvage a pretty okay day overall and was able to mitigate the points disaster there in the end. But it was definitely not the day that they were hoping for. And that still puts him in kind of a precarious spot heading into next week's cutoff race, as he's right now currently in the playoffs, but he's only got a 7-point cushion over ninth place driver currently, Harrison Burton.
I will say this though, and this is something actually. So me and you are in a group chat. Me and you were talking about the race and everything, and I even said, I'm like, no, Ross's car is fine because Colby just squared him right in the door. If you don't touch the wheels, you are fine. Now, Talladega and Daytona, you're a little aerodynamically dependent, but if you can stay in the pack, stay in the top five, you can stay in the top five. It's not like, oh, well, you know, I'm restarting 25th, and I'm just going to hold back here because I want to. You're kind of forced to at that point. But with this, it truly was something that his car, the whole right side was destroyed between the tires, and that's the safe haven because he didn't have he didn't have any suspension or tire issues. Yes, he did kind of get a tire rub, which happens with that kind of stuff, but the fact that he was able to get demolished in the right side door and finish sixth on the day just says a lot about that car and that team.
Oh, yeah, no, and definitely that's what I was getting at with there being for a second there some speculation that maybe his day was done. Was because it wasn't quite clear at the onset when the contact hit, if Howard hit him squarely in the door or if he had, like Zach said, made contact with the wheel. Because if he had hit the wheel, there was fear that maybe he had broken a lower control arm. But thankfully, like Zach said, the contact was squarely in the door between the wheels, so none of the suspension components were hit, and he was able to salvage a top 10 run and still keep his playoff hopes alive, because coming into the season, a lot of people pegged him as being the championship favorite. And while he's been super consistent, the winds have not fallen his way. And right now he's needing some good runs to come next week and the next few weeks if he hopes to be one of those drivers with a shot at Phoenix for a championship. But no, that was one of the stories that really stood out to me, especially with all the colleague racing dominance to not have him be a bigger factor was one thing. And also, A.J. Allmendinger, he also was kind of like hanging out in the back, just kind of letting the race play out, and was going to try and drive up there at the end. And he was in contention, but he got swept up in that backstretch crash that ultimately would end the race under caution and leave him with a 24th place finish. So back-to-back races for the Dinger, where it looked like he might be able to pull off a win, but instead was sent to the garage on the rollback.
Well, that wasn't anything of Allmendinger. And you got to look at the numbers, too. He led 24 laps. You know, of all the drivers of that day, that was the highest out of Chase Briscoe, who led 73. The fact is that, you know, Dinger, he can wheel. We know that. And that's something that I love to see. And I think there's rumblings that AJ might do a full-time stint with colleague if he can get the funding behind him. So if you got about $20 million and you want to sponsor a guy that's proven himself both on the road course and at Oval, go to Dinger. Dinger will definitely get you a ding-a-ling-a winner. if you really want to get that. But, I mean, honestly, the colleague cars have been just – it's weird to say that they're the dominant factor for the Chevy team. Because, yes, we have had some great runs from Junior Motorsports, and even this weekend we had some great runs by them. But in all honesty, it seems more or less that Colleague Racing tends to be more up front than Junior Motorsports. Justin Allgaier is a driver that we see all the time up the front, or at least most of the time, as well as Noah Gregson. But then you have Michael Annett, who – you know, his car was deemed illegal. He got sent way to the back. He did not – he essentially got credited for the last place finish. And then the 8 car, which some weeks is great. Last week we had Daniel Hemric, who finished, I believe, 2nd. And then this week, he finished 5th in the same starting spot he had. So it's something kind of weird to say that the colleague cars are a little more dominant, are faster than all the other Chevys in the camp.
See, this is where I'm going to differ from you again. I still think Junior Motorsports is the class of the Chevy teams. Allgaier with 3 wins now, and Noah Gregson with 2. So they're 5, I feel like, you know, definitely outshine the numbers by colleague. And I feel like Allgaier definitely matches Chastain in regards to consistency. And I feel like Gregson has been way more consistent than Justin Haley and has been towards the front of the points for a majority of the season and actually been in the top 3 for a majority of the year. So I feel like I get what you're saying, that the colleague cars have definitely stepped up their game, but I still feel like they're solidly the number 2 spot behind Junior Motorsports, which still is the standard bearer. Even though Michael Annett has not had the flashiest of seasons, he still had a relatively solid season, picking up several top 10s. The 8 car has been super inconsistent, but it's not really been anything, you know, speed-wise with them. They've just been, unfortunately, in a lot of bad places at bad timings and gotten to several wrecks, not of their own making. So I feel like while they may have slipped a little bit, I still feel Junior Motorsports is the number 1 Chevy team in the Xfinity Series.
I don't know. But I will say this, the championship for this is shaping up quite odd. And before we even leave this, we have to say Ryan Sieg yet again outperforms possibly his equipment, but possibly everyone else's expectations. He finished 8th in both segments and then gets a 2nd place. I was like, when we were going on the backstretch, I'm like, is Sieg going to try to pull something? Because he might just get the underdog win and secure himself into the next round this early.
He was looking real prominent there for a second. And honestly, he still has a very, very good shot heading into the Roval. You know, the nice thing about road course racing, it's kind of an equalizer as far as equipment goes. Sieg is not super flashy when it comes to the road course, but thankfully, thanks to good runs at Vegas and now at Talladega, he doesn't need to be flashy. He just needs to have a super solid, safe afternoon. Don't outdrive the equipment. Make good strategy calls. And if he just minds his P's and Q's, there's no question about it. He should be able to walk away with a round of eight playoff berth, which would just be fantastic momentum for that family-owned team. And just what a fantastic capper on what's been so far a groundbreaking and trend-setting and record year for him in his career.
Dude, I just can't believe that because – honestly, you look at the beginning of the year for Ryan, you know, him and his family-owned team, you think, okay, they're going to have a great year. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be this, it's going to be that. Because last year, I remember them having quite a run-up for themselves in the Xfinity Series, you know, starting off with the first six races, a top four or a top five, and then just, you know, a basically worst finish in the top and the from Daytona to Richmond, a worst finish of 12th, and then after that it kind of staggered down. But this year, that same one, obviously a little different because of COVID and everything, his worst finish came to us at Atlanta with a 35th. He only has two other finishes that are, you know, along those lines, Kentucky and Texas. And other than that, it's just bringing it home in solid finishes. Second here, fifth at Las Vegas, top 15 across the board at both Richmond races and at Bristol, and Darlington finishing third. I mean, it's just that consistency that might get him a championship if everything works out. If he gets to the Final Four, he could pull a Matt Crafton and honestly win if as long as he runs really well at Phoenix, which his Phoenix numbers aren't the worst, but it just takes those three, the other three guys, to really run too hard to cause him to win the championship, because they'll run each other too hard or he'll just jump on an opportunity and win.
And who's to say if he makes it to the championship four, who's to say there's not some extra room in the budget to maybe purchase a special car from RCR for that championship bout, which would be such a well-deserved investment. Cause I genuinely believe that Ryan Sieg deserves the chance at an actual shot at the championship, because he has shown that he can do a little with a lot. And I would honestly prefer to see it as financial backing to his family-owned team. Having gotten this far, you know, doing it that way, it would honestly mean a lot more, not just for him, not just for his family, not just for the team, but for the sport as a whole, to have him rise to the pinnacle, a championship crown, with his family-owned team, because honestly, that would bring the sport kind of back full circle to where it all began, when you had farmers, you know, stringing together what they could on a family saloon and just, you know, packing up the car to head to a race week and to just get away from the, you know, the mundane and the modern for a while and chase the dream, chase the American lifestyle, you know. And so I hope that that's what this opportunity opens up. But it would also be great just to see Ryan Sieg maybe get an opportunity at like a Junior Motorsports or Hendrick Motorsports, or maybe even with RCR, since they're forming such a close relationship, to get a top flight ride fully funded where he doesn't have to worry about that. And all he has to worry about is going out and driving. But knowing Sieg and why he's built this team the way he has, and not just the fact that it serves his driving purposes, but also that he's been able to groom and grow so many drivers and develop so much young talent, I feel like Ryan Sieg Racing is going to be a staple in the Xfinity Series for a long time, and I just hope that they continue to keep reeling off finishes like this, exceeding expectations, and just opening up more doors to potentially seeing something that we've not seen in a good few decades in the sport that is badly needed at a time like this to really invigorate the core fan base and bring them back to the sport.
That is for sure. And if you think about his opportunities he's had, he actually has raced in Cup Series a little bit. BK Racing, it was a deal basically where he would be in one of their cars in hopes that that they would use a Ryan Sieg pit box and stuff like this. So an interesting thing. And an actual race for Premium Motorsports last year at Indy where he finished 24th, which is good. But I just look over all his stats and you know, you see him have those random good finishes from 2014 to 2017, a Daytona a third, and then a second at Iowa in 2017. And then after that, it's just like, okay, he keeps improving and improving. And if you look at Wikipedia, which you can't trust because these are the race stats, you look at his last 2 years, and there's more orange than there ever has been. So it's great to see, and hopefully we'll see him, you know, get that opportunity. I'm hoping he does have the opportunity to get to the to get into maybe a Junior Motorsports car, or maybe a RCR car, or maybe even just give him a new chassis or let him buy a brand new chassis, because it's an interesting world buying used parts off of bigger teams.
Oh, I can imagine. You probably have more insight on that than anyone in the social media sphere. So definitely some very valuable insight here on the Charlotte Line, having you on the podcast for that. But, I'll be interested to see where they go from here. But kind of, you know, before we wrap things up here, kind of looking down here, we'll give you the full field rundown, maybe take a look at the breakdown of the caution flags here. Like we said, Justin Haley did come across the line in first. After the disqualification of Michael Annett, Ryan Sieg was credited with a second-place finish. Noah Gragson came home in third, Brandon Jones in fourth, and Daniel Hemric rounded out the top five. Ross Chastain brought the number 10, battered and beaten, to a sixth-place finish. Josh Williams, an impressive run in the number 92, to a seventh place. Garrett Smithley in the 07 brought home an eighth-place run. Brandon Brown, who's, you know, got to win next week if he wants to keep his impressive championship run going. But still, everything he's done so far this year has been just exceeded expectations at every level and really continues to set the bar. But Brandon Brown brought home a solid top 10 in ninth place with the 68 Chevrolet. And then Alex LeBay, a 10th place run in the number 36. Chad Fincham brought home the 13 and 11th. Then Anthony Alfredo came home in 12th. Cesar Vaccarella, making one of his few starts of the year, brought the number 90 home in 13th. Timmy Hill in 14th. Tommy Joe Martins in 15th. Joe Nemechek brought home the 47 in 16th. Mike Harmon right behind him, his team owner, in 17th. Josh Balicki in 18th. Chase Briscoe in 19th. He was running amongst the lead pack there, but got bumped out of the way coming to get the white flag and had to settle for a 19th place run. Behind Briscoe was Jeremy Clements in 20th, Matt Mills in 21st, Vinnie Miller 22nd, Harrison Burton 23rd, A.J. Allmendinger 24th, Jesse Little in 25th, Myatt Snyder 26th, Brett Moffitt in 27th, Cody Vanderwall 28th, Justin Allgaier 29th, Ryan Vargas, his first outing in the TikTok Chevrolet, not what he was looking for. He got swept up in a crash and brought home the 6th in 30th. Joe Graff Jr. brought home the 08 in 31st, Jeffrey Earnhardt 32nd, Austin Hill making a rare appearance in the Xfinity Series for Hattori Racing. He got swept up into a couple accidents and had to settle for a 33rd place run. Austin Cindric got turned into the inside wall and left Talladega 34th. Riley Herbst also hit the inside wall and left 35th. Colby Howard, like we said, made that contact early with Ross Chastain, and that ended his day in 36th. And then Michael Annett, after his disqualification for the ride height being outside NASCAR regulation, he left with a 37th place run.
He left. He gone.
He gone. And, you know, there's really not much more to say there. Just like the Cup Series, they're going to be going to the Charlotte Roval this next week in what is going to be an elimination race to set their round of eight. Currently, right now, as you look at the playoff bubble, for drivers like Riley Herbst and Michael Annett, they're currently 11th and 12th. They definitely must win if they have any hopes of making their way into the round of eight. Above them, you got Brandon Brown in 10th and Harrison Burton in 9th. Realistically, are within mathematical reach of being able to make it into the next round. Currently, right now, Brandon Brown is 19 points back. And Harrison Burton right now finds himself 7 points out. So both could. Anything could happen on the Charlotte Roval, but still a bit of a gap to overcome there. So right now you got Ross Chastain. He's plus 7. Justin Allgaier right now is plus 19. You got Ryan Sieg. He's got right now a safe 27-point cushion. Then you've got a 34-point cushion for Brandon Jones, a 44-point cushion for Justin Haley, and then virtually guaranteed to be locked in Noah Gregson and Austin Cindric into the next round. So a lot of speculation there and a lot of excitement. And what a great racing venue to go to for a cutoff race like the Roval. It's proven to be a great fixture on the NASCAR schedule since its inception in 2018, and definitely proven to be one of the most unpredictable tracks on the circuit. So really excited for the Xfinity race next weekend, or I guess this weekend.
It's a weekend, and I can't wait for it either, because racing at Charlotte is great. Racing on the Roval is great because we've had – I think, what, three or four races at there, and we've had three different – this will be the third one?
Yep, 2018, 19, and then 2020 will be the third one.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, wow. Shows how much I know. But, no, I can't wait, because that track itself, because we had Jimmy Johnson, Martin Truex Jr. battle it out, and then Ryan Blaney wins. And we had last year Chase Elliott, who destroyed his car going into turn one, somehow wins and just does a nice burnout right there on the center. So I can't wait for it. But talking about the
– that'll bring us up to the Cup Series. And,
nothing happened.
Controversy. Take us through it, Zach. What did we see over 500 miles?
Let's see. We saw crashes. We saw spins. We saw debris. Oh, we saw a flying car.
Well, we did see.
Yeah, Kurt Busch was – well, we saw a few technically. We saw Kyle Busch, Kurt Busch's brother, get a little airtime on the fifth caution, I believe, of the day, or fifth or fourth caution, got a little airborne, was still able to keep it straight, keep it going. And about 50 laps later, Kurt Busch was like, hold my beer, and went over three different cars, including old teammates and a car he used to drive, the 41.
Oh, yeah, no, that was one of the most spectacular moments of the event. If you saw any of the photos of him, where his car is literally suspended in air above those three cars, Bowyer, Cole Custer, and Ryan Preece. It's just absolutely breathtaking. And he was able to walk away. But honestly, I saw that moment, and what a more perfect encapsulation of the highest of highs and lowest of lows of NASCAR. Literally last week's winner, the guy that won at his home track, had so much momentum, was coming into Talladega on such a high, leaves it after taking one of the most horrendous wrecks of the afternoon, barrel rolling, flying over cars. Just is the most beautiful representation of our sport, honestly.
I will say this. He did not have like what Brendan Gaughan had last year at this race, where Brendan Gaughan did actually do a barrel roll, landed on all four tires, and drove away back into the pits to go to the medical center. But yeah, Kurt Busch went airborne, somehow did not flip, which I was surprised, but went up over former teammates' cars and back down on his wheels. And I could only think he pulled the Ricky Bobby. He's like, I'm in the air. This ain't good.
Oh, yeah, no.
No?
And especially after his time in the commentary booth, you had to know that was going through his head, because he is a avid fan of Talladega Nights. He's run a couple of Ricky Bobby schemes. He loves dropping the Ricky Bobby quote. So there's no doubt in my mind that when he was flying through the air, he was definitely saying, I'm airborne. Yep, this is not good.
I just want to get back on the ground. But, yeah, I mean, this race overall was – this race overall was crazy, not just because of the fact that it's Talladega and we have, you know, one more race before we get to a cutoff. Not only do we have a lot of people going for it, we have a lot of smaller teams getting the opportunities to run up front. Timmy Hill technically led a lap. Bubba Wallace led a handful of laps before he got into an accident. You had people, you know, just the top five alone. You have Denny Hamlin's race winner, Eric Jones, Ty Dillon, William Byron, and Chase Elliott. Of them, Ty Dillon, I did not see getting in the top five. Then you go into the top 10, you have Ryan Preece, who got in two different accidents, still managed to finish 10th. Brendan Poole, your favorite driver, John Hunter Nemechek, and even, you know, Tyler Reddick, who hadn't had a stellar past few races, all in the top 10. This is what I love about plate racing. It doesn't matter what kind of equipment you bring in. As long as you bring a motor that can keep up with the draft, you can guarantee yourself a decent finish if you can keep it clean.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. Anything can happen. And honestly, in the spirit of anything can happen, who would have thought that if anything could happen, that one of those scenarios would be defending champion Kyle Busch, winless, right now entering the cutoff race for the round of eight below the cut line. Only once since we've gone to this playoff format has Kyle Busch not made it to the round of four, that being the inaugural year in 2014 when he got cut off, when he got eliminated in the round of 12 after a rough wreck at Talladega. Just not the season he envisioned at all. And once again, you know, he had a bad run, got swept up into an early wreck, got swept up into a couple more wrecks, and was finally officially declared done on lap 189. And it was just problem after problem. And he is definitely in a must-win situation heading into the Charlotte Roval, not exactly where he wanted to be, but if you would have asked me that a year ago, if we would have seen Kyle Busch winless at this point, I would have said you're lying. There's just no way.
Oh, I'm right there with you because of the fact that Kyle can win anywhere. He's won at every track that we go to. That's a fact. That is not something that is this or that. No, he is in fact won at every single track NASCAR goes to in the Cup Series right now. And it's crazy to think he's gone a full year. And that just shows, I think that more or less shows what kind of driver Kyle is. Kyle is a one hell of a wheel, man. Especially this weekend, it kind of showed the fact that he was able to take a car, essentially that was junked at one point, still be able to run up front, run in the top five, or even the top 10, and stay up there until carnage happened. But I think it shows that he is a driver that does excellent and excels when he has practice, whether it's racing another series at the same time or getting the 2 hours of practice that we normally get. So it's crazy to think that in his whole career that he's been building up that he's getting to a point kind of like Jeff Gordon. Jeff actually had a lull like this for a couple of years where he didn't win any races, and this was before he retired. I remember this was back the COT days, if you remember that car, big wing, big splitter on the front. There was a year or two he didn't win a race, and then he came out swinging where he matched Dale Earnhardt Sr. at Phoenix, where he won as many races as Dale Earnhardt won. And then that year alone, winning, I think, 5 or 6 races, even though he didn't win a championship, he was damn near close.
Oh, yeah. No. So I definitely see, you know, him being able to rebound again. He still has a chance, you know, logistically. And, I mean, it is Kyle Busch. If there's anyone who could pull it off, it is him. So he could theoretically, you know, keep his title defense hope alive this next week, but I don't see this continuing into 2021. I feel like they'll eventually get the ship righted. And honestly, at times it just seems like they're really just one good break to go their way, a win from getting a victory that'll open the floodgates to allow them to really start racking up the wins and the points. So it'll be interesting to see how they rebound from this year. But still, I just continue to be baffled by the curious case of Kyle Busch. But as far as the race goes, holy crap, 13 caution flags. 8 of those were for a wreck of some kind. It started right from the very get-go on lap one, heading into the very first corner. Part of the, you know, some of the issues with not having practice, there wasn't something apparently set up right on the number 95 of Christopher Bell. And a piece of the suspension cut down the tire heading off into the first corner, and he went for a round, triggering a 4-car pileup, which ended up, you know, inciting some damage on the number 8, the number 13, and the 43. But all of them were able to continue. And then from there, you know, arguably one of the favorites heading into this weekend, on the very next restart, we went a lap, and then before we knew it, Ricky Stenhouse Jr. was backwards into the inside wall. So again, that put us under the yellow flag, and then We got one more lap of caution under that restart, and then we had to go back under the yellow flag for the 32 being stopped on the track. And then we're like, wow, are we ever going to see actual green flag racing? But after that caution flag, we got a nice, solid 10-lap stretch of green flag racing before the competition yellow. And then from there, the race kind of found its groove. You know, we settled in. We got some longer green flag stretches there in stage one there to try and get things through there. We had a couple of accidents, most notably, of course, being the one that swept up the number 3 and the number 10, which essentially ended the playoff hopes for the number 10 of Eric Almirola. Also involved in that were Kyle Busch and Alex Bowman. Like we said, that also pretty much effectively ended Kyle Busch's hopes at a championship unless something turns around drastically for him this next weekend. Then before we get to stage two, and obviously the big moment of stage two being there with about 10 laps to go, the big accident on the front stretch where Kurt Busch decided he was going to be an aeroplane and start flying, flying towards the line. That one took out several drivers, including drivers in the championship, including Kurt Busch, Austin Dillon, Brad Keselowski. Clint Boyer was wrapped up in that. Kyle Busch, again, wrapped up in that accident. Also, Cole Custer involved. And then we eventually ended stage two. And then stage three ran, honestly, for the most part, without incident. We had one debris caution there towards the middle. But then as the lap started winding down, that's when the intensity started to ramp up. With about 5 to go, we got our first yellow flag that set up our first green-white checkered attempt. This one was going to be our first overtime attempt, and it didn't get too far. We had an accident on the front stretch involving the number 4, the 6, the 8, and again the 18, the final accident of his afternoon, the 19 as well as the 22. So that precipitated another restart, and we were doing well. And then we had another 6-car pileup that put us back under the yellow flag to set up one final attempt at a green-white checkered finish, putting us 12 laps past the scheduled distance. And then, well, shit kind of flew off the handle. We got to the white flag lap, got to an official race. We are in the backstretch. Matt DiBenedetto, he's leading the event. A driver who's trying so desperately to get that breakthrough win. A driver fighting for his ride for next year. He's got the win in tow. But coming barreling with a head of steam is the Daytona winner, William Byron. Byron throws a move to the inside, and DiBenedetto goes for a block. He blocks a little too much, forces Byron down onto the apron. Behind them, Chris Buescher kind of, puts a blocking maneuver also on Denny Hamlin. Hamlin, trying to avoid not only Buescher, but as well as the sideways Byron, goes for an evasive move to the apron below the yellow line. Two things to unpack from there based off of NASCAR's ruling on how that went down. They viewed in their judgment that Matt DiBenedetto and Chris Buescher forced a blocking maneuver that forced a driver below the yellow line, in this case being the number 11 and the number 24 respectively. For that reason, they black flagged Chris Buescher and Matt DiBenedetto and moved them to being the last two drivers on the lead lap in Sunday's finishing order. With that move, they also deemed that Denny Hamlin, who made the winning pass when he went to make that evasive maneuver on the apron, in NASCAR's judgment, they viewed that Hamlin was forced below the yellow line, and his move was deemed to be a legal pass. And when he got around to the start-finish line, he was by far and large had the win over Eric Jones, who would be awarded the second-place finish after Matt DiBenedetto was moved to the tail end of the lead lap. And this would be Denny Hamlin's second win at Talladega, 7th of the year and 44th of his career. But to say that this created an uproar in NASCAR Twitter would be the biggest understatement of 2020. People were pissed, and rightfully so. The yellow line rule, since its inception in 2001, has been arguably one of the most controversial rules in the NASCAR book. And the reason for that is it's such a touch-and-go rule. And there's rules that are supposed to be pretty black and white, but their enforcement has been gray, to put it mildly. We've seen it, infamously in play with the 03, Aaron's 499 with Dale Jr.'s pass. Was it legal? Was it not? For better or worse, he got the win. 2008, the Amp Energy 500. Tony Stewart throws a block, forces Regan Smith below the yellow line. In that incident, Tony Stewart was not penalized, was handed the win, and Regan Smith was penalized for going below the yellow line. That one, also super controversial. To this day, 12 years later, I still think NASCAR made the wrong call, but no ifs, ands, or buts about that. We saw the comeuppance of that event, you know, the very next spring when a similar move went the opposite way, where Brad Keselowski held his ground and ended up putting Carl Edwards into the catch fence. So definitely you kind of have to speculate on the ruling there. But even in recent memory, Justin Haley comes to mind in 2018, where he kind of made a move that looked almost dead on identical to what Denny Hamlin pulled. And in their ruling, Justin Haley was denied that win at the 2018 Xfinity race at Daytona. So it's been a ruling that has unfortunately come up a lot. We saw it being a point of controversy in last year's championship race, for not only the Truck Series, but also the Cup Series and that finish. And we've seen it again this year. So, Zach, the question I have to ask you, the question being asked across Twitterverse, is it time to do away with the yellow line? Is it creating more harm than good at this point?
The very, 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 very hard thing about the yellow line rule is that there is instances where a driver, I'm just going to say, I'm going to put it like this first before I talk. I'm going to call it cheating. If you go below the yellow line, you are cheating. NASCAR said that. That's what it is. Now, in NASCAR's defense, a driver getting forced below the yellow line by another driver, NASCAR won't call you on that because they will actually penalize the driver that forced you. What seems to me and what seems to be odd is that NASCAR isn't enforcing that rule only if it's the lead pack or if it's the lead cars. Because there was instances where there was cars being forced below the yellow line, but those cars were actually just a lap down. And yet, neither driver is being penalized. And then we have this incident where Denny Hamlin, he was actually still having forward momentum. He wasn't passing anyone, but he was still going forward under the yellow line. NASCAR rule states you may not move forward, you may not gain position. Even though he wasn't gaining position, he was gaining to get a position. To me, I say either A, get rid of the yellow line rule, or penalize both parties for it. If, let's say, Denny Hamlin goes below the yellow line, penalize him. Matt Benedetto sends Denny below the yellow line, penalize both of them, unless Denny Hamlin backs off and gives his position back. It's either you do one or the other. To me, I would say no more line rule. But if you go to Talladega or Daytona, and you basically go down to the apron and run it all the way around, well, then you have something figured out no one else does, and we're going to have to impound your car and see what you're doing. Because I'll let you speak, but real quick, there's no way you can run fucking on the apron the entire way around both Daytona and Talladega. To me, I say get rid of the yellow line rule. It's either It hasn't helped anything. Brad Keselowski made a great example of that. He held his line, and he spun Carl Edwards into the catch fence and knocking into Newman on the last lap of that race at Talladega. Regan Smith won that race, and we know it.
And, you know, and the thing with the yellow line rule that's really, you know, I feel like why it needs to go away is that the purpose for which it was created – It doesn't serve that purpose, and it really never did the way that they envisioned. It was brought about in 2001 after the Daytona 500 that took Dale Earnhardt's life, and the reason they brought it in is because they were looking at the aggressive racing that we saw that Sunday, where drivers were literally going down to the grass and just making these darty, flashy moves. And what NASCAR had hoped when they put that out-of-bounds line in was they would hope that drivers wouldn't be making those dicey dive bomb type moves that eventually, you know, go awry and clip a driver's bumper and send them into the outside wall in front of oncoming traffic, kind of like what we saw in the final moments with Dale Earnhardt in that 0-1-500. But what we've seen is, honestly, by shrinking the surface like that and moving that you know, you can't go there line up a little bit and creating a distinct apron like that, you've kind of put drivers in more of a box. And honestly, I feel like the crashes have been bigger because of that, because now the drivers have to be contained in this little bubble. And when they make an oh shit move, they don't have the wiggle room to get out of it. And honestly, you know, the drivers are, I get what you're saying, but I don't think with the yellow line rule, you know, going away, you're going to see a driver trying to race the apron. I don't think that's the whole deal. But you're going to see a lot more drivers, you know, not afraid to you know, really sail it off and to make a move to the inside to really, if they've got the momentum going, to try and see where that run goes, because they don't have to worry about running out of bounds. Obviously, they have to worry about running out of racetrack, but that's kind of where the way it is at all of our racetracks. You know, we don't have anything like that at any other racing surface, like an out of bounds line. So from just an officiating standpoint, I would like that more, you know, from consistency. There's more consistency in the calling. There's more consistency in how we monitor and regulate the races. So I would like that from that aspect, you know, especially when trying to introduce new drivers and explain the rules. I mean, introduce new fans and explain the rules to them. So I don't know. It'll be something to keep an eye on, and it's going to be definitely the topic of conversation for the next couple weeks.
That is for sure. So would you like to do a rundown of the finishing order, and we will end for the night because we are getting close.
That sounds good. So taking you through that finishing order, Denny Hamlin picked up the win. Eric Jones came across the line second. Ty Dillon in third. William Byron fourth. Chase Elliott rounded out the top five. Ryan Newman, an impressive comeback to finish sixth. Tyler Reddick, after being involved in that lap one incident, rebounded nicely for a seventh place run. John Hunter Nemechek at 8th, Brennan Poole a very solid outing in 9th, and Ryan Preece completed the top 10. Justin Haley making a rare appearance in the Cup Series, a very impressive 11th place run. Austin Dillon, after being involved in several incidents, was able to recover for 12th. Quinn Houth finished a career best 13th, Alex Bowman 14th, Timmy Hill in 15th, Matt Kenseth 16th, Joey Gase in 17th, Brad Keselowski 18th, Cody Ware in 19th, Kevin Harvick rounded out the top 20. Matt DiBenedetto, after his penalty, finished in 21st. Chris Buescher behind him in 22nd. Martin Truex Jr. 23rd. Bubba Wallace, after having a strong run, unfortunately would crash out and finish 24th. Ryan Blaney would finish right behind him in 25th, also being involved in that same incident. Behind them was Joey Logano 26th, Kyle Busch in 27th, Corey LaJoie in 28th. Jimmy Johnson did not have a great run in his final outing at Talladega. He brought the Ally Chevrolet home in 29th. James Davison came home in 30th. Cole Custer, 31st. Last week's winner, Kurt Busch, in 32nd. Clint Bowyer, 33rd. Daniel Suarez in 34th. Brennan Gaung, making his final NASCAR start, wrapped up his career with a 35th place run. Michael McDowell came home in 36th. Eric Almirola, 37th, Ricky Stenhouse, Jr., 38th, and Christopher Bell, after his lap one incident, finished 39th.
Well, that is the rundown for Talladega. Always hectic, always fun. We head to the Roval, where we can expect chaos, and I think more chaos. Yet again, we have two chaotic races back-to-back, really.
Exactly. So for all of us here on the Charlotte line, we thank you for tuning in. Zach, it was great to discuss this with you. I'm sure there'll be plenty more news to drop here in the next week, and I can't wait to unpack it all with you guys next week on the Charlotte line.
I got money saying next, the moment we end this, the big news is going to break in like 20 minutes.
Oh, for sure. That's how it goes. But we'll break it down for you when we come back next week.
Bye.